morning news.
Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. We're going to take a look at something that is really none of our business, actually. Except, David, we have the patient's permission to do this, right?
Mm-hmm. She didn't want me to give you a name, but she was fine with me putting up all of her bills and everything on this on my website.
Okay, we're talking about a patient's medical bills. Dr. David Belk is a doctor, as the title would imply, but also runs a website called TrueCostOfHealthcare.org. And he has made it his life's mission to try to understand why hospitals charge what they do. And in this case, Dr. Belk, the patient underwent a liver transplant for liver cancer, correct?
For liver cancer.
And is doing well, I understand.
Very well.
So what was your object in examining her bills?
Well, first the case, all right? She was diagnosed with liver cancer in December of 2015. She got the transplant in 2017. But one of the first things they do while you're waiting for a liver, they got to stop the cancer from spreading. So they do something called chemoembolization, where they literally inject chemotherapy directly into the tumor. The amount billed for that was $116,884.
Wow.
Which certainly sounds like a lot of money, because it is, just for that procedure. But Medicare, because she has Medicare only approved 13,000 of that. Now, this is a single procedure in a single day, so $13,000 is hardly chump change.
Yeah.
The part that Medicare didn't pay of that total bill was only $1,288, because you're only responsible for a portion of what Medicare approved.
Does anybody pay the $100,000 charge?
No, of course not.
Then what is it there for?
Show.
Just for show.
Just for show. The sparks start to fly in late June when she gets hospitalized to actually get the transplant. How much does the actual transplant cost, right? I'm sure that's what everyone's curious.
Yes.
So the whole liver transplant, start to finish, including the hospitalization and all the doctors who saw her in the hospital, including the radiologist, the pathologist, the gastroenterologist, the whole nine yards, surgeon, $60,086 from the time she entered the hospital till the time she went home, right? And the portion that Medicare didn't pay is $3,626.
Well,
right?
Very affordable. So
right.
Where's the problem? Why are you going through this exercise if the bottom line is that medical care is affordable for this woman's liver transplant, and she is recovered and doing fine?
It is affordable, but it doesn't look affordable, right?
Okay.
Now, you know, people are talked into buying, for example, supplemental insurance. For example, this woman was.
Mm-hmm.
Now, she and her husband together pay a total of $359 a month for a supplemental plan that covers all the extra non-covered Medicare charges, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking $11,000 of the total amount she would have paid for this possibly most catastrophic diagnosis you can get, or one of the most.
Yeah.
Which means that between her and her husband, one or the other would need a new liver about every 3 to 4 years for this supplemental insurance to be worth it.
So what you're saying is that people look at these bills and they're frightened into buying supplemental insurance, but the fact is Medicare's flat fees really pay for everything.
Very reasonable.
Yeah.
Very reasonable, and they cover just about everything. And even in the absolute worst case scenario, the amount that you would owe would barely amount to what most people pay for a used car. And I'm talking a used Honda Civic, nothing fancy, right?
All right, so then this idea that medical costs are wildly inflated, I mean, it may look that way on paper, but if you've got Medicare, you have good coverage.
If you have Medicare, you have about the best coverage you can have anywhere. And yet people go to these private insurance companies because they're frightened by, you know, all the bills they might get while they're in Medicare. And I always say, look, Medicare is not perfect. But going to a private insurance company to get away from all of the problems of Medicare is a little bit like moving to Beijing, China, to get away from the crowds and pollution in Los Angeles. Okay, you're not helping yourself.
Do the hospitals who are responsible for scaring us with these high list prices, do they at least say that in their brochures, saying now, even though
absolutely not.
They don't say that?
No, absolutely not. And most doctors don't understand the system well enough to explain it either. In fact, there are more than a few doctors who bought supplemental policies themselves. That's what's so weird about this system.
So your message here is that when you see these ads for supplemental Medicare insurance and you see these outrageous charges for things like liver transplants, don't believe it, because Medicare does not pay those outrageous prices. And
they protect you from the fictitious overbilling better than any other type of insurance there is.
So is that why the idea of Medicare for all seems to be going nowhere, because it would be way too good of a deal for way too many people?
You could easily argue that if it were a Medicare for all system, you would sap more than $1 trillion out of a $3 trillion economy. So part of the problem is it's a hugely, shall I say, inefficient and in many cases fraudulent system. But you have to unwind that fraud. You can't just suddenly remove it any more than you could easily redirect the Mississippi through the state of Colorado.
Wow. David Belk runs trueCostOfHealthcare.org. Dr. Belk, thanks very much.
Pleasure to be here.
Republicans in the state Senate are demanding that Democrats end plans to hire an investigator to look into the rape allegations against Senator Joe Fain, who ended up getting defeated. Kyrita's Hannah Scott is here with more on that story. Remind us again of the allegation here.
Okay, so shortly before the election, a Seattle woman, Candace Faber, went to social media. This was right after the hearings for Supreme Court Justice Kavanaugh had wrapped up. She went to Twitter and announced that Senator Joe Fain had raped her nearly a decade ago in Washington, D.C. The two had met. There was a night of drinking. He, according to her, had talked her into helping him to his hotel room, at which point he coerced her and forcibly raped her in the hotel room. Now, he immediately denied that. He immediately called for an investigation, but because it was more than a decade old and she had refused to file a police report, there was never any police investigation about this. At the time of this incident, he was not a state legislator. He was working for King County Council Member Pete Van Reichbauer,
and
he was there. He was there on business for them. So, but it was beyond that time. So King County Council wasn't going to investigate it. There became an increasing number of calls for this investigation. And when it looked as though Senator Fain was going to win re-election, a committee in the legislature, a bipartisan group of lawmakers on that committee, agreed to have an investigation, an ethics investigation into him, hire an outside investigator to look into these claims. Now, he lost his re-election. So what Republicans are now saying is they're calling on Democrats to end this investigation because they say there's no point at this point. This is Senator Randy Becker, Republican, who is asking for Democrats to end this investigation.
I was the one that seconded the motion for the investigation to move forward when we thought that Senator Fain was winning his election. But Senator Fain lost his election. So for this investigation to go forward at this point in time is absolutely absurd, as it doesn't serve any legislative purpose.
So under the guidelines, the way they set this investigation up, it would have this outside investigator would look into these claims, however, but there's no due process for Fain, essentially, the way it was laid out is their point. And so she says moving ahead with this when he's lost re-election is pointless, because the only reason for them, the legislators, to get involved is to keep him from being seated in the legislature. And now that he's lost, there's no point. She says it's just a partisan witch hunt.
Now, we all agree there should be an investigation, but it should be through the correct channels, not through the Senate. The Senate does not have the authority to do this unless they're looking at seating or not seating a member.
So what she said yesterday was that they had sent a letter to Democrats, the Senate Democratic Caucus, on the 21st of last month, asking them to, because she said when they agreed to have this investigation that the Democrats had agreed to revisit this if Fain lost his reelection, which, again, he has. And her letter on the 21st was ignored, she said. So now that because of that, it's almost 2 weeks later, she's coming public with this letter with these demands because she thinks maybe that the Republican or the Democrats won a few seats and now they don't feel like they have to listen to the Republicans.
I'm not sure if it's because there's new leadership or if they're just choosing to ignore us because they think we are of no value as Republicans.
I see. But what we're not hearing is what the alleged victim thinks here. Now, is
She has not filed a police report?
She has said she will not file
a police
report.
And she will not file a police report.
Yeah, she was, it was asked of her some time ago after these became public, and she didn't think that that would serve any purpose. When the legislature came out and announced that they were going to do this investigation, she made very clear again on social media that was her goal. That's what she wanted. She wanted to keep him from getting that seat in the legislature.
So then she's satisfied as well.
As long as they, but I think she wants this investigation. She's satisfied
she
that he didn't win. I think she wanted it addressed in there, and she was because at some point after he lost his reelection, Democrats came out and said they were going to continue with this investigation, and she was again on social media saying she was pleased by that. That's where she wanted it addressed. But, you know, they're not wrong. I'm not sure what it will do. It won't keep him from being, you know, he's already not going to be seated. Democrats, I expected to get an official reaction from them to this yesterday. I did not get that. But what I can tell you is what I'm hearing is, look, Joe Fain is still a state lawmaker until next month. They feel like this is the right thing to do to address this. And they say that Republicans have been getting in the way. They've tried to hire an outside investigator a few times, and Republicans have blocked that. So
But the alleged victim apparently wants the Senate to carry out justice, because she's not going to file a police report.
Yes, because she doesn't feel like that would be justice.
What would justice look like then? Just a report? I mean, because he's already out as a legislator.
And to have this played out in where he's still a legislator until next month. That's where she wants to see this played out. It remains to be seen if that will happen. Randy Becker, Republican, says if Democrats move ahead with this, she said it will poison the relationship on a partisan level moving into the next session and make it very hard for the Senate overall to do its job.
Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
All right, it's Hannah Scott.
Choke
Points.
Let's go.
Brought to you by Online Trading Academy. We are once again going to warn you about the big one. I'm not talking about the earthquake, although that's always out there. But, of course, the period of maximum constraint when the Alaskan Way Viaduct closes for good on January 11th, the whole Highway 99 corridor through Seattle will not be available for you to use. But there are, even though it's not the 11th yet, there are some changes that will come even before the final barricades go down. So, Chris, tell us what we're going to see.
All right. The Washington Department of Transportation has finalized its plans for the 3 weeks that Highway 99 is going to be closed. And that includes some early tweaks that will help in this process. So on December 14th, the state's going to start shortening the bus-only lane on northbound 99. They're going to shorten it by about 1,400 feet. That shortening is going to happen at the south end where the lane begins along the Port of Seattle. Also on December 14th, the state's going to be shortening the right turn lane to Harrison Street on southbound 99. That's in South Lake Union. The state's also going to be reducing the lane widths in that entire area there as they get ready to tie in and deal with tying in 99 there into the tunnel. And then on January 4th, the ramp to northbound 99 near the stadiums is going to close. So all of those things are going to happen before January 11th when the entire situation or entire Highway 99 closes. So we're about a month away from this major disruption. City of Seattle's Director of Downtown Mobility, Heather Marks, says losing Highway 9 was going to impact just about everybody, and her agency is preparing.
We're going to monitor, manage, and adapt our existing transportation system in real time.
They want to be flexible. They're going to be working hard to tweak signals, move accidents where they can. They want to be able to move anything that pops up quickly.
Our Transportation Operations Center is now operating 24/7 so that we can make those signal changes on the fly.
And the city's also doing something that's very important. It's putting a priority on keeping the public right-of-way open. So you should expect fewer lanes blocked by construction. You know how lately you could come around something and like all of a sudden a block will be, you'll lose a lane because there's a truck there offloading materials or whatever. Right. They're going to be very cognizant of that to try to keep that to a minimum.
We are limiting permits during this time of closure so that construction projects are less able to use the public right-of-way for construction to maximize the space for the traveling public.
But the city, as you know, can only do so much. A lot of how the city gets through this time is going to be up to you, the traveling public. You know, find a bus, find a carpool buddy, telecommute, off shift if you can. Any little bit should help. And that goes for both private and public employees. And you should give those options a try over the next month so that you aren't making your first attempt at an alternate plan on January 11th, because not going to be a good...
Rehearse your carpool, huh?
Yeah, exactly. You're going to need several dress rehearsals if you want to try to change things for those 3 weeks.
Okay, so you mentioned a bunch of ramp closures. The main way I use 99 is to escape from Seattle Center after some kind of event, right? You get on there, one of those little streets, and then you can scoot right down and get off at the start of I-90. Is that going to remain open until the 11th or not?
Yes. As far as I know, yeah, that ramp there, you were talking there in South Lake Union coming from Seattle Center.
Yeah.
And you work your way down. Yeah.
You get to the exit at the stadiums.
Correct.
For I-90.
And then you would get to take over the 4th Street or Edgar Martinez go up early.
Right.
Yeah, that should be open because what they're closing is, let me double check that.
It's the on-ramp. Right?
It's the on-ramp. The northbound at the stadiums is going to close on January 4th, about a week ahead of time.
And these narrower lanes, what's behind that? I didn't think the lanes on Aurora could get any narrower.
Well, what they're doing is they're reducing the length of one of those turn lanes, and they're going to narrow through that area just in anticipation. It's because they're going to have to, you know, finagle that as we work tie-in 99 there. So I'm not exactly sure why they're doing that ahead of time, but that's just one of the things they're doing that's going to help in their transition to tie in the tunnel.
Well, I can't wait. If ever there is a reason to get to know a stranger who's going in your direction, I guess this would be it.
Yeah, definitely. Find a friend.
Yeah.
Find a friend or talk to your boss and let them let you telecommute for 3 weeks.
We should have sort of commuter mixers. Commuter Tinder.
Nice. We could do that, and we could use those autonomous cars like we saw the Tesla from yesterday.
Yeah.
We could, if they're going to be mixers.
Your Daily Dose of Kindness now. It's brought to you by Spring Free Trampoline. A former firefighter and paramedic in Palm City, Florida, isn't about to stop saving lives just because he retired. Louis Garcia, he remained disturbed by the opioid epidemic. Of course, it's nationwide, but in Florida, it's bad, too. And he said the sheer number of opioid overdoses he sees is bad.
People too young are dying. They're too young to die. I felt helpless hearing about all these increasing opioid overdoses. And ground zero, believe it or not, we believe is parking lots and public restrooms.
He tells WPTV that he dug into his life savings in retirement and bought Narcan. It's the overdose reversal drug that even around here is stocked at businesses, available at pharmacies without a prescription. And he just handed them out. He went to businesses in town, gave them Narcan. And more than that, he taught them how to use it, gave them a 90-minute CPR class, too. He wants people to be prepared. It's just a spray that, when administered, revives an overdose victim.
They leave here feeling comfortable, and most importantly, they leave here with the medication.
And on the day WPTV followed him around, he gave out about 20 doses, businesses eager to learn about it, wanting to help. And his plan now, even in retirement, is to purchase up to 400 doses of Narcan over the next year, all to save lives.
It's time for our Sports Insider, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealer. Now, here he is from that magnificent ice castle of sports, 710 ESPN. Today is the day we find out if we get an NHL team. That's pretty much baked in, right?
Yes.
It's the when that we don't know.
Yeah, but we kind of know that, too.
All right, so what's it going to be, 2021 or 2020?
2021.
2021.
It's what it looks like. The NFL a little skittish about the Oakview Group's timeline.
Schedule.
Thought they were trying to get too much done and didn't have enough.
Something about constructing room. Things in Seattle.
Wiggle room. They worried. They're clued into the Seattle process. Yeah. That's what I think their penalty kill name should be. In the NHL.
The Seattle process?
The Seattle process. Because it'll just bog everything down. Because when you get a guy gets a penalty, maybe for boarding, Dave.
For boarding?
Yeah, boarding.
Let me look that up.
A cross check. Perhaps fighting, perhaps a major misconduct, then you're a man down, and you've got to be able to exhaust the time.
Like
the
when you get a bender?
I don't know if bender's a penalty. Bender's what you go on weekends.
No, that's
maybe
what happens with
you
your ankle.
Specifically.
Not Dave.
It's also a derogatory term for a player who bends their ankles when skating.
Ooh.
Oh.
He's a bender.
He's a bender.
You're right, it's not a penalty.
Yeah.
All right, so we're going to get an NHL team.
Yes.
And we're going to have an NHL team play games in Seattle, just not till 2020. I mean, we've waited this long.
Correct.
Who cares?
Yeah,
right?
that's kind of how
Isn't
I look
that,
at it.
Yeah.
I want to get to the business of the team name. What are they going to
be?
Do you guys
do we have a timeline for an announcement on that?
No.
Are going to send it out to the public?
Find out more tomorrow.
Yeah. I still like the Seattle Freeze.
Do you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I could see that.
The Sock guys are fun, too, if they let us throw fish onto the ice.
Yeah. huck a few salmon out there. The problem with the sockeyes, and I'm a big sockeye proponent, the problem with the sockeyes is that it gets eaten by everything.
Mm.
Like, the sockeye is not a ferocious fish.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically a foodstuff.
Okay.
So,
but it's delicious.
All the reports will say so-and-so devoured the sockeyes yet again.
Yeah, sockeyes, right. Flounder.
Yeah.
And there's debut game.
Something's say. Fishy with the defense.
Say.
Who's the gun belly up?
Who's hooked again.
Glub went the team.
Another filet at Key Arena. Are we done?
I think. Do we have any more?
Gutted the sockeye.
Gutted the sockeye. That's good.
We're gonna have to chum around for some victories.
Okay. So, is there anybody
I'm
left
trolling
on the...
for compliments?
Is there anyone left on the Mariners?
Yeah, there are some people left. I don't know how good they are. Gene Segura gone. He's gone to Philadelphia for a fella named J.P. Crawford. They also got rid of a couple relievers in that trade. And then Edwin Diaz and Robinson Cano traded to the New York Mets. I like that deal. We got a couple of different real high-profile prospects from that team. Justin Dunn, who's a right-handed pitcher, and then Jared Kelenic, who is an outfielder. And Kelenic is a very recent first-round pick, a top 10 selection, somebody that's a great athlete.
These are too many names for me to remember this early in the season. But let me ask you this question. They traded away Gene Segura because, well, he wasn't hitting well, but also he is 31 years old, and he's going to be 32 in the final 2 years of his contract. And then they pick up someone named Carlos Santana, who's 32 years old.
Right.
So what
Santana's significantly cheaper. Santana's not the part of the rebuild here. This was Gene Segura still has a significant amount of money that he's owed. And when you project out 3 or 4 years from now, you don't think he's going to. That's when you're hoping to be really good. He's not going to be as good a player as he is now. It's better to get rid of that money, get that money off of your books right now. Carlos Santana is not as expensive, and you're not committed to as long for him. This is about making sure that you get younger players who will be cheap and good when you hope to be good, and getting out from under guys who are aging. Robinson Cano, 2 years from now, it's unlikely he's going to be as good as he is right now. So it's about unloading the future liability. Is it like risk hedging?
We shouldn't be talking about this publicly because other teams will then do the same thing and beat us.
No, everybody's already been doing this.
Oh, I see.
They're already better than us.
We're kind of late to the party here, Dave.
Playing catch up.
Maybe you saw that story in the Seattle Times about how Governor Inslee's State Patrol detail needs more money because of all the trips he's been making around the country as the head of the Democratic Governors Association. David, what association is he the head of, Jay Inslee? Do you know?
I believe that's right.
Yeah, okay. And coincidentally, some of his duties as head of that association take him to states that might figure in the 2020 election. And so everybody's pretty much sure that Jay Inslee is going to make a bid for president. So we've called up Pulitzer Prize winning reporter David Farenthold of the Washington Post, as we do every Tuesday, to assess the Inslee buzz in Washington. So what are you hearing about Jay Inslee there in D.C., David?
I mean, it's impossible to escape. Everywhere I go, the coffee shops, the restaurants, it's just Jay Inslee all the time.
All the time?
My kids, elementary school, everybody's talking about him. Actually, nobody is talking about him.
No.
There's a lot of Democrats who are going to run for president in 2020, and Jay Inslee may be among them, but he starts out, I think, at the back of a pretty large pack in terms of name recognition, in terms of support from people for his ideological positions. He is, for better or worse, coming into this election, if he chooses to run, kind of an unknown.
I was covering politics when I worked in Georgia in 1976. That's what they said about Jimmy Carter back in, 74 when he started running. Why not the best? And sure enough, once he raced through Iowa, it was pretty much guaranteed.
I mean, the problem is he's going to have to, if he does it, he's going to have to knock off people like Beto O'Rourke if he runs, Kamala Harris, Cory Booker, people who start out with a lot more name recognition. But as you said, Jimmy Carter, Abraham Lincoln, it's been done. There's been surprises before, so I'm not ruling it out.
Let me throw another name at you. Howard Schultz.
I don't think that's going to happen. I mean, I think Howard Schultz can make a big difference in politics, a big difference in America, given the money he has. He already has made a big difference. But, you know, the Bloomberg Schultz kind of centrist, you know, billionaire kind of figure. Mm-hmm. I mean, people say, yeah, Donald Trump got elected in, you know, as a rich guy who hadn't been in politics before, but he was a famous rich guy who'd been on television. And people knew rightly or wrongly as a, you know, a great business mind from The Apprentice. Both Schultz and then, to a lesser degree, Bloomberg just haven't had that kind of exposure. You know, they're going to need to be extremely charming to, you know, in addition to very rich, to make any sort of impact.
So the path to the presidency runs through network television these days, huh?
Probably. I mean, you think about the people that show up highest in the sort of, you know, very, very early stage polls now. It's people who have been in the public eye for one reason or another. Biden, Bernie Sanders, Beto O'Rourke is in there in some degree, Elizabeth Warren. You know, nobody's really standing out. I mean, it's a bit like the Republican field in the beginning of 2015, which, you know, where everybody thought Jeb Bush was going to get there, but he only was like, he was leading like 16% to 14%, and then Trump just blew them all away.
Yeah.
So it's possible somebody grows out of the ones names we already know, or maybe somebody comes from the outside.
Obstruction of justice. I saw a piece in your paper, The Washington Post, implying that the president's tweets themselves, sort of dangling these pardons and congratulating people who have promised to stonewall in the Russia investigation, that those tweets themselves may constitute intimidation, corruptly persuading another person. I'm reading the language now of the obstruction statute. How serious is that?
Well, I mean, I think the tweets you're mentioning, where he's encouraging Roger Stone, one of his associates, to continue not talking to Mueller when he's calling for Michael Cohen to be given a long prison sentence because he has talked about Trump. I mean, he's acting like a mob boss, you know, he's like a mob boss with a Twitter account with millions and millions of followers, you know, rewarding and castigating people depending on what they've said about him, not whether they've told the truth or complied with the law. The judge in this situation, though, is not me, it's the Senate. You know, if the House House impeaches Trump for obstruction of justice based on what he's done in public or what Mueller finds he's done in private, it's going to be the Senate deciding whether they think he's obstructed. So, you know, I could say it looks like obstruction of justice to me, but my opinion doesn't really matter here.
What if it turns out, and by the way, do you have the timeline for the Mueller report? Is it coming up before the end of the year or not? Do you know?
Nobody knows. I mean, what I think we're going to get a preview of what Mueller has at the end of this week in this it's sort of a side issue in the Manafort case. There'll be some sort of memorandum put out about why Mueller thinks that Manafort lied, and people believe that there's going to be something in that report that will describe something of what Mueller knows about Trump. Because one of the things that Manafort has supposedly lied about is what Trump knew. So we may get a peek at what Mueller has as early as Friday, but as far as the full report, I don't know. I don't think anybody knows when it's going to be done.
The thing is, we're getting to where, you know, Mueller lied about what Trump knew about a hotel project that never happened. I mean, this is a long way from a conspiracy, it seems to me, to manipulate an election. And Trump's allies, of course, are saying this is going to be a big nothing burger. Suppose it turns out to be a big nothing burger, that it was all the lower level associates who were doing what they thought Trump wanted, but there's no explicit connection. Does it end there, or do the Democrats still try to run with something?
Well, you know, the Democrats are going to be looking at all different aspects of Trump's presidency and his, you know, campaign in 2016. And so, you know, if it does end with sort of definitive proof from Mueller that Trump didn't know what his lower level associates were doing, then the Democrats will investigate him on a variety of other fronts. I kind of doubt it will be that definitive, but who knows? It's hard for me to prejudge that.
You think they'll go after him for emoluments? Do you have any updates on that case?
Yeah, there's a couple things happening with emoluments. There's a lawsuit that we've talked about where the D.C. and Maryland attorneys general sued President Trump, saying he violated the emoluments clause, which says presidents can't take payments from foreign powers. That today, I think, will go to discovery. So the D.C. and Maryland attorneys general, I think, today will be allowed to make demands on Trump's business and say,
Whoa. Seriously? Mm-hmm. So does that include the tax returns then?
At this point, it does not include the tax returns. That could be a later phase of this case. But at this point, it's demands on his, you know, businesses to say, who are your customers? What do they pay you? You know, who are your foreign government customers? What do they pay?
I see. So we'll actually see a list of that, of all the foreign countries that have done business with the Trump organization, huh? But at that point, don't you have to decide whether they paid more than just the normal hotel rate to constitute some sort of gift?
Well, there's a legal question of whether that matters, but I think that what they're going to ask for is certainly not only who paid, but what they paid and whether they paid the same rate everybody else paid.
Wow. David Farenthold joining us live from the Washington Post. David, thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's a beautiful day in this neighborhood, a beautiful day for a neighbor. Would you be mine?
Seattle's Morning News with Dave Ross. I'm Carolyn Osorio. Of course, everyone of a certain age recognizes that tune and the man behind it, Mr. Rogers. Mr. Rogers passed away in 2003, but his legacy lives on in our hearts, at the Fred Rogers Center, and now at Harvard.
We're building a collaboration between the Early Childhood Initiative here at Harvard and the work of the Fred Rogers Center in a way to take some of the ideas that are deep in Fred Rogers' legacy as well as in the science as we understand it and to take it out and to impact the field of early childhood.
That's Junlei Lee, former co-director of the Fred Rogers Center. Now he's at Harvard, spearheading an exciting new curriculum based on two factors, the teachings of Mr. Rogers and decades of science that says a child that ends up doing well has had at least one caring relationship with an adult.
I sometimes call that kind of the at least one principle of human development, that all of us at some point needed at least one person who trusted us, who believed in us, who pushed us, and who interacted with us in a way that told us we matter to them, that our learning, our growing, our feelings matter to them. And sometimes if you're a young child, you may not even remember who that person is.
The curriculum isn't for kids. It's for their caregivers.
We cannot make a lasting impact on children by skipping over the adults in the middle. So in order to serve children and families better, our entire system, entire educational and social services system must work better for the helpers who are working with children and families every day.
Not everyone is a Mr. Rogers fan. Over the last decade, there's been some pushback over some of Mr. Rogers' teachings, particularly his belief that every child is special.
You are my friend. You are special.
A decade ago, Professor Donald Chance from Louisiana State University says he gave his two cents in a piece by Jeffrey Zaslow in the Wall Street Journal with the headline, Blame It on Mr. Rogers, Why Young Adults Feel So Entitled.
You know, when I was talking to Zaslow, I said, you know, they were all taught by Mr. Rogers that they were special. That may have not been my exact words and all. And so they grew up believing it. And, you know, he jumped on it and just thought it was fantastic little reference and all. So, you know, it just took off.
Fox News glommed onto that envelope and pushed it even further.
This evil, evil man has now ruined a generation of kids.
You know, next thing you know, all the vitriol starts rolling in. And just people who weren't behaving the way he wanted you to behave, was trying to teach you to behave. You know, just vicious stuff. I had a point to make which really wasn't about him. I think the thing that Rogers taught that was good was love and being nice to people. But I think it was this part about that you're special and all. That part troubles me. If they're starting to teach that people are special, then, you know, well, everybody can't be special. It just defies the definition of the word.
And that's the rub, the tightrope walk between unconditional love and teaching kids about grit. Junlei says Mr. Rogers, in his way, was all in when it came to grit.
Look at almost any kind of episode. You find that it's very much about persistence. It's very much about keep working on it, whether it is your relationship with your neighbors or whether it is something you want to learn to do. Mr. Rogers showcases, right, all these wonderful artists and musicians on the program. But he doesn't talk to the musicians about their fame. He talks to the musicians about how much they practice and how much they turn their love for the craft into their practice. There's this even, you know, kind of frequently sang song in the Mr. Rogers neighborhood called You've Got to Do It. And it starts with, like, you know, you can make believe that it happens.
Or pretend that something's true. You can wish or hope or contemplate the thing you'd like to do. But until you start to do it, you will never see it through.
Because make-believe pretending just won't do it for you.
I think Professor Chance and Mr. Rogers are more alike than you might think. Both are educators wanting kids to have a better life.
there's no prescription as to, well, it's all talk like Mr. Rogers, but I think all of us can afford to ask ourselves the question, what is deep and simple? Right? What is deep and simple about us? What is deep and simple about our work that we think could make the world a better place? And just trying to communicate that as honestly, as simply as we can.
You've got to do it. Every little bit, you've got to do it. Do it, do it, do it.